so insanely fascinating that it managed to bootstrap itself out of nothing. And all of it is self-referential, you know, like you have no external influence, monetarily speaking, on the network. Like it's set in stone from day one. The fact that it absorbs value from the outside, that's what gives it relative value. And I think I had this insight not too long ago, like Bitcoin started with zero price and it will end up with zero price again because we won't have any fiat money left to measure it.
Hello, my fellow Bitcoiners. I'm John Chenot, and welcome to episode 11 of the Bitcoin Path podcast. This is a show where we have deeper conversations about Bitcoin and self-sovereignty, about how this new magic internet money is changing the world and changing ourselves at the same time. In this episode, I'm excited to share with you session 3 of the Cosmic Deep Dive online event, led by Gigi. This was an interactive online event that took place on December 12th and the 13th of 2020. It was 2 full days of back-to-back immersive Bitcoin educational webinars with some of the leading educators in the space. We had tremendous feedback from everyone who attended and overall just had an amazing time. Keep an eye out for future events like this one coming up at thebitcoinpath.com. Also, you can find Gigi on Twitter with the handle @DirGigi. With that, let's get into this episode. It's my absolute pleasure to introduce Gigi for this session. For those of you who don't know, Gigi is a Bitcoiner and an Austrian writing words and code for Bitcoin. His first book, 21 Lessons, is one of the most recommended books among Bitcoiners. And if you haven't heard of it or you haven't read it, I highly recommend you check it out. There are also, I believe there's a free version that Guy Swan has read on Bitcoin Audible, right?
Yeah, exactly.
He's gone through all of them.
The book is available for free online as well. Like it's released under an open source Creative Commons license. So it's on GitHub as well if you want to compile it and print it out yourself. But you can read it online on 21lessons.com, and you can also buy a paper version and an audiobook version. But the audiobook version is online for free as well. It's just not as nice as the one you'll get from Audible.
Right. And you're also creating your second book called 21 Ways. Can't wait to see that come out. And prior to taking the orange pill, just a general introduction to Gigi. He was a researcher and software engineer, leading multiple Bitcoin development teams that worked on critical large scale apps. And he's currently the senior engineer at Swan Bitcoin, which is an excellent on-ramp for purchasing Bitcoin, just getting onboarded into the new system here. And he's passionate about security, privacy, and of course, Bitcoin. Gigi is an excellent, and in my experience, an elegant communicator of complex ideas. And just, I love his hilarious sense of humor and just is a genuinely good dude. Gigi, thanks so much for joining us. I'll let you kick it off, man.
Take it away. Yeah, thanks for having me. That was like the most formal introduction I ever got on any Bitcoin podcast. Congratulations on that. That was very thorough. You did your research. So yeah, all of that is true. And I somehow managed to transition into Bitcoin full time. So, you know, like I somehow managed to actually make writing words and code my full time occupation now. And so that's really something. So it tells you that we're living in a very weird, strange world. And I think, you know, the testament that you're speaking to a ghost in cyberspace, like that's something as well. I took advantage of the lockdowns and the fact that everyone is communicating via Zoom. So you can actually make yourself invisible online if you like to experiment a bit and know what you're doing. So it's more like, yeah, it's You know, like a lot of people know who I am, and I went to conferences, so they obviously know what I look like. But I want to prove a point that privacy is not that. And I think Satoshi has proven that very nicely as well. You know, like you can still have private communication online, and the tools exist to make yourself invisible in cyberspace. So that's the whole idea of the floating sunglasses. And yeah, as you said, I'm currently working on my second book. As all writers know, writing is a bit of a pain and hard work, so I can't wait to read it as well. Like, I can't wait to have the finished book done. I aim for 2021, so I still have a little bit of time left, and I wrote I'd say I'm like 20 to 25% there. I wrote the first 4 to 5 chapters, depending on how you count. It will be 21 chapters again, like 21 lessons. That also had like 21 small chapters. This one will be a little bit larger, and I hope to illuminate Bitcoin from 21 different perspectives. So the whole title is 21 Ways to Look at Bitcoin. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're here, because Bitcoin is just so complex and multifaceted that you can illuminate it from so many different angles that it just attracts people from all walks of life and thinkers from all kinds of backgrounds. And it's very technical in nature. It's very philosophical as well, if you look at it the right way. It has a lot of interesting monetary properties. You can look at it as purely a financial tool, for example, and there's so much more, you know, like it's as you said, it's this funny internet money. And that's still true as well. You know, it still is funny internet money. It's still, it's this strange thing that you can send around that it actually has value. So there's no end in sight in terms of fascinating aspects of Bitcoin to explore. So I think I still have a couple of things to write about. I think what I hope that someone gets out of this is that it should be obvious that there is more to Bitcoin than meets the eye. And the whole idea of my new book, 21 Ways, can be distilled in one sentence that I really like, and that is, Bitcoin is different things to different people. So in a sense, Bitcoin is kind of a mirror, and it shows you what you like to see in it. So if you have a finance background, then you think it's a financial thing. If you have a computer science background, you think it's like a computer science communication protocol, or maybe a distributed system. And all of that is true, you know, like it's all of those things. And what I might want to explore in the beginning is to talk about the idea of Bitcoin and examine the prehistory of Bitcoin as well. Like, the idea of Bitcoin, the idea of cyberspace money, so to speak, it was around for a long time, like in science fiction, and the cypherpunks tried for decades to create something like that. And everyone who knows his like internet protocol stack and the HTTP error codes, for example, everyone knows that it was assumed that we're going to have something like Bitcoin at one point in time. It just, like, nobody knew that it would be that complicated and it would take that long. On the other hand, Bitcoin is also kind of, you know, simple once you grasp, like once you grok how it really works. All the puzzle pieces were there already. So there's also a very interesting article by Gwern. I think the title is Bitcoin, What Took You So Long? Or I think it might actually be Bitcoin is Worse is Better. I'm not sure if those are two different articles or if it's one and it's just a subtitle. But he goes into great detail of explaining that Satoshi didn't actually invent anything new, so to speak. Like, all the parts were already there. He kind of glued it together with a little bit of the secret sauce. And the secret sauce is basically the difficulty adjustment that was the big thing that was missing, so to speak. But there was so much build up to Bitcoin, and you can see that by studying its prehistory. There was DigiCash, and there were the cyber bugs that were built upon on DigiCash eCash system. There was a concept in 95 by Glassman that was called Millicent, which dealt with micropayments and did a lot of work in that area. There was famously eGold. And all of those systems were still flawed. Like all of these, some took off a little bit and some were even shut down, like eGold. And famously, now we come to the puzzle pieces of Bitcoin that Bitcoin kind of absorbed and used to its advantage to make it work for it, which is of course Hashcash by Adam Back, like the proof of work that Bitcoin uses was basically presented by Adam Back in this paper. And of course we have all the other previous work that Satoshi cited in the white paper, like BitGold and B-Money, and also, what a lot of people point out is the reusable proof of works, RPAL by Hal Finney. And all of that, once you look through these puzzle pieces, it's really astounding that, like, how close everyone was to building a system like Bitcoin. Like, especially Szabo with BitGold, he outlined how such a system could work. It just was not implemented. And also, YDAI with B-Money. Like, both of these systems are basically telling you how it could work, but it was never implemented until Satoshi came along and kind of figured out the right tricks to make everything work. And I think that's why people find it so fascinating as well, that it kind of seems at first glance that this thing cannot work, you know, like all the previous systems failed. So the first reaction is always disbelief and criticism. And like even in the announcement post, the first reaction instantly is like, you know, like the first answer to the announcement post is like, this system can't scale. You know, like if you want to build it like that, everyone needs to have access to all transactions to check everything, so it can't scale. If you want to have it used worldwide, then it just doesn't work. So the whole debate that unfolded like over almost the span of 10 years and ended in like a very prolonged debate and the first contentious hard fork, like this the criticism, so to speak, and the things that you can't point out about Bitcoin, it existed from day one. And it's really instructive to study Bitcoin's history and also its prehistory, because in terms of criticism, like there's nothing new under the sun. Like everything you read on Bitcoin Twitter today, like still all the pain points that critics bring, and they think they know what they're talking about, it was refuted, and their rebuttals on Bitcoin Talk from like 2009, 2010, 2011, like in the first couple of months, we went through all that already. So it would be very useful for people, I think, to study this history for the critics and the proponents alike. So yeah, now we have the system and it obviously works, and we're now in Bitcoin's, like we just had Bitcoin's 12th birthday, depending on how you count, you know, like some people count the white paper, some people count the Genesis block, and there are some other like important dates in the Bitcoin world as well. And I think what Bitcoin proves without a doubt, that this idea of cyberspace money, like it actually works, you can actually make it work. And that makes me so insanely bullish, because even if Bitcoin would fail, and I don't think it will, I think it's too late for it to fail. Like, but you never know, you know, like it's, you can always have a black swan event that wipes something out that we are just not aware of. Like something, a mathematical assumption could be wrong. Something in the cryptography could be broken. We could have a technological breakthrough that makes other things obsolete. We could be dead tomorrow. Like we could wake up and realize we're living in a simulation. Like there are many things that could actually happen, you know, like there was recently like a joke going around on Twitter that Bitcoin was actually gonna crash the simulation, because hashing just takes up so much CPU power of the simulation that the simulation is going to slow down, and you see glitches, and you can see that happening already because the world is so crazy. So I can get behind that conspiracy theory. I really like it a lot. That would be a great science fiction novel.
It's like a Rick and Morty episode. I'm pretty sure there's one like that.
yeah exactly, yeah that's right, that's how Rick breaks out of the simulation, I think. Like and everything glitches all the time. Yeah, so But to get back to the original point, like we now have this idea that actually materialized. And I think that's it's so insanely great to actually now have something in the world that works. And it's by no means perfect, you know, like if you a lot of the people that actually work on Bitcoin, a lot of the core devs, they know exactly that, you know, it wasn't architected beautifully. It has its flaws, and it, you know, there are many things that could have been done better from the beginning, but it doesn't matter. We have this system, and from the very first block, it grew organically. And the whole idea of the system, like the meta idea, so to speak, of Bitcoin, is that the design is set in stone from day one, as Satoshi said, and the whole value of the network forms around the consensus. So any consensus break, every hard fork would be catastrophic. And so the meta idea of Bitcoin is Bitcoin's soul, so to speak, stays intact. And we will never hard fork unless it means the death of the network. I think that's the one meta idea of Bitcoin. And I think that's also why so many people that were on the sidelines previously are now starting to pile in, like Michael Saylor. He famously said, for him, it was never clear that this is going to work. But now we saw with the first debates around the contentious hard fork and how this played out, and that we actually defeated that with a user-activated soft fork. And it like everyone agreed that we must not destroy the purity of Bitcoin's soul, so to speak. That this is such a strong signal to the market as well, that this thing is here to stay, and everyone who uses it and is invested in it agrees that we want to have this unchanging, reliable system, unchanging in terms of monetary policy. Bitcoin, of course, changes all the time, you know, like the software is patched and new nodes come and go, and miners come and go, and so on and so forth. So that brings me to my main epiphany, and I have to thank Brandon Quinn for that, and also in turn Ralph Merkel, that Bitcoin can be best understood as a living organism. And the fact that it changes all the time underneath, it's like your cells, the cells of your body renewing, you know, but you still stay the same thing, kind of. And Bitcoin in that sense is more like a process than a thing. Just like life is more like a process than anything else. And the pattern of Bitcoin repeats and stays the same. And I think it goes to show that just by implementing this idea, you kind of get in a weird territory, which makes it really difficult to understand from the get-go. And Satoshi famously said as well that, I think he wrote something like, I'm sorry to be such a wet blanket when it comes to a general description of the thing. Like, there's nothing to compare it to. And he's absolutely right. Like, it's so difficult to explain to people what Bitcoin actually is, because there literally is nothing else to compare it to. It's a completely new thing. We never had digital scarcity. We never had absolute scarcity, for that matter. The closest we have is the scarcity of time, of our own lifetimes. And Bitcoin beats even that, you know, like in a sense, the time, since it goes on, it is not strictly scarce, you know, it's just our human life. So like the time on Earth, on that we have on this planet, is very, very scarce. But Bitcoin is absolutely scarce. It's not like this concept didn't exist before. And I think everyone still tries to wrap his or her head around it. And it's just, you know, it has the power to mess up your mind. I'm sure about that. Yeah, I don't know. Any questions so far?
Yeah, I think a lot of us, even in this afternoon session with John, experienced a little bit of messing up of the mind, and it can be somewhat. I almost feel like an energetic, like drain, to some extent, because so much thought power is going into some of these concepts. But I'm also, I don't know, I'm maybe some people can withstand it a little easier than me. Does anyone else have it? Zen, do you have something to jump in here with?
Yeah, John. I'm still buzzing with the energy that John has left me with with the last conversation. So I'm a little buzzed too. But yeah, I really would like to say that the point that again Gigi said on the thing staying constant, it again comes back to the same thing, right? That your body changes, right, and all the cells changes, right? In that sense, I really like that the thing about this concept of digital scarcity staying here, right? Even if let's say Bitcoin fails, right, this thing is not going away. This understanding of hard money in terms of just information and it's getting a little too, I'm not being very very articulate with the words, but I think I just wanted to add that. yeah
absolutely, like, and I can see how Bitcoin discussions can drain the mind, so to speak. Like that's definitely happening when you so a deep dive like this is definitely an exercise for the mind. Let's put it like that.
Yeah, we're dealing with some very abstract concepts here, right? But Bitcoin kind of enables us to explore those realms, which I think is why all of us are here, right? To kind of expand the realms of our own understanding and of reality and potentially what reality could look like. So that's part of the process. That's really exciting. Does anyone else have anything they want clarified or comments at this point? Cool.
I can go into detail of something that most people don't really think about, and it also relates to an article I really like, which is called "That Bitcoin is a Decentralized Clock," and that's something that most people don't really like. Most people don't actually realize technically what Bitcoin had to solve and what the problem actually was. And the result of it is obvious, like Bitcoin produces absolute scarcity and Bitcoin solves the double spending problem. But what that entails to solve the double spending problem in a decentralized way, it's really something that's worth thinking about. And I can highly recommend this piece that's called "Bitcoin is a Decentralized Clock." And I also have a chapter on this in my upcoming book, which goes into detail of the problem of timestamping and how timestamping systems evolved and how timestamping in a decentralized fashion is really problematic. And it's not only problematic from a like computer science Byzantine generals problem, it's just problematic from a pure physics standpoint as well, because on Earth, from one point of the globe to the opposite point of the globe, even if you're moving with light speed, you'll have like 50 milliseconds of delay. That's approximately the every computer gamer knows this, you know, that's the best ping you can get if you're playing with the opposite side of the world. So what relativity teaches us is that there is no such thing as a simultaneous event. You can only like, and we have no, and that means that we don't have an absolute order in our universe. So you can kind of visualize that if you ignore light speed for a second and ignore all the relativity talk. But if you have two explosions that are like a couple of miles apart and you're in the middle of it, if the two explosions happen at the same time, you will hear the left and the right explosion at the same time. I mean, that's just everyday experience. That's completely intuitive. And if you're closer to explosion A, let's say to the left one, you'll hear the left one at first, and it seems like the other one exploded later, even they exploded at the same time. And it's very, very similar with light cones and how information travels in our universe. But you have to throw the idea of simultaneously out of the window, because with the relativistic effects of our universe, you actually cannot say what happened before and what happened after. It's very similar to how clocks, for example, work at a different speed once you enter relativistic effects, like once you travel really, really fast or near something that's really heavy. And that's also why the GPS satellites, for example, have to adjust their clocks for it to work, you know, like, and it's not that they have the wrong time. It's just the time works different when you're a GPS satellite, because they're moving so quickly and they are away from our gravity well. And all of this, like timing, it relates to the order of events, because if you want to know what happened before and after, you need to have an authority of time. You need to have like one single universal clock that you can trust. And then you can say, okay, no, like actually this one happened first and this one happened after. And that's absolutely essential for a ledger, because order is absolutely essential for a ledger. You cannot spend money that you don't have already. Like you can only spend the money that you already got from someone else. And so ordering is of the utmost importance. And you cannot solve this problem in our universe like to a perfect fidelity, because you will always run into this synchronization dilemma because of relativistic effects. And if events happen under this 50 millisecond duration, for example, and they would happen all the time, you know, like if you have a global network and people send messages all the time, you cannot say which message came first and which one came after. And that's just based on physics. Like I'm not even talking about delays in routing or corruption of messages or anything like that. And Bitcoin solves this so beautifully, because it actually introduces its own notion of time. Like it does away with human time completely. It does away with the physical time that we have completely. Like the timestamps of the transactions and everything, they don't really matter too much. That's also why you see, like, you sometimes have the phenomenon that a block that has a timestamp that is younger comes after a block that has a timestamp that is older. So it looks like the blocks are in reverse if you look at the timestamp. But the only thing that matters in Bitcoin is the block time. So the only, like what we call block height is actually block time. And Satoshi initially called the blockchain, what is now known as the blockchain, actually the time chain. And that's the whole problem that Bitcoin solves. It solves the absolute order of events in a decentralized system. And that you have to think about it in that way. You need to rely on the authority of time. And when you have no one with a clock, like if everyone has a clock, that can't work, because that's imprecise. You could cheat, you know, like I could set my clock back or forward and just pretend that I haven't sent the money and so on and so forth. So that never works. You need an absolute authority in terms of time. Like you need to decentralize time itself. And Bitcoin does that so beautifully using, again, the laws of our universe, using proof of work, anchoring the work that went into it in energy. And that's how everything works. That's how everything fits together. And it only works because computation takes time, you know, like that's what we rely upon. It's not necessarily the amount of energy that went in, like that's true as well, but it's kind of just a proxy. It's just, you need to crunch through so many numbers, and that takes time. And that's how it actually works. And that's actually the problem it solves. Like it solves the problem of keeping the time in a distributed way. And I think it's so beautiful. And that's why I also call myself like a time chain maximalist. I hate the block, like I hate the word blockchain with a passion. It's, but it's a very nice litmus test, you know, like if people start talking about crypto, like that's the first litmus test. And you can basically stop talking to them or try to educate them depending on your mood. And if they keep talking about crypto and they use the word blockchain a lot, then it's really an indication that they haven't really understood what's going on and what Bitcoin actually is and what problem it solved and how those things work. And so time is absolutely crucial. And I like it's the first time that we have something that is true for everyone on the globe and provably so. So Bitcoin in this sense is also a truth machine. Like, because we have this one single thing, like this source of truth that is used to, I mean, it's it doesn't sound so profound if you just talk about what it's used for, you know, like it's just a list of transactions. It just, it tells you who owes what to whom, basically. But the way it does it is absolutely profound. And I really like the idea of Bitcoin as a truth machine as well, because it's definitely something you can rely upon. And it's also something that is incorruptible the longer you wait. Like the further you go back in time, the more true everything becomes, the more reliant the information is. And like there is no such thing as absolute truth or absolute certainty, so to speak, unless you enter the mathematical realm. And but still, you know, like you have the incompleteness theorems, and you kind of, mathematics itself is like a self-referential construct, and you can only inside this construct generate certain truths, so to speak, but you always have to rely on axioms. So I don't believe that there is anything like absolute truth, but I think Bitcoin is the closest approximation that we have. And the further back you go in the time chain, the higher the assurance that this actually happened. So that's also why you should not trust like the first confirmation. You should at least wait a little bit and so on and so forth, because that's actually also how the system works. Like you can always have splits and you can have network splits, and you just need to wait a little bit on this until this resolves itself, and you can make absolutely sure that this is actually what happened. But if you look back like a couple of hours or a day or even a week, you can be absolutely sure that that happened, and that is the order that it happened. You can also be absolutely sure that everyone sees the same thing. And I think it's mind-blowing that this is possible, and you yourself can verify that this is true. Like if you understand it, how it works, and it's not that difficult to understand. Like it's once you get the like the building blocks in your head, like the primitives that Bitcoin uses to operate, like what is a hash and what is a signature and so on and so forth, then you can definitely verify all of that yourself. And of course you can use software for it to verify all of that very, very easily. And so it doesn't matter that this is like a probabilistic time. It still works, you know, like it's not a clock in that sense, that it ticks every, like exactly every second or something like that. You know, like every Bitcoin block that's coming in, it always takes approximately 10 minutes. Like it doesn't matter what, like that's also something to keep in mind. Like there is no, it's a progress free process, mining. So even if the last Bitcoin block came in like 1.5 hours ago, how long would you have to wait for the next Bitcoin block to come in? The answer is 10 minutes. The answer will always be 10 minutes. It's very hard to wrap your head around that fact, but it's more like every single hash attempt has a certain probability to find the block. And there are just many of them, but there is no progress towards a goal. So it doesn't matter how many, like since the search space is so high, it doesn't matter how many hashes have been tried before. Like it's basically zero. At all times, 0% of hashes have been tried. Like that's how improbable it is to find one. That's why you can just throw them away and don't count them at all. And that's why it's always 10 minutes. And it's such a cool little piece of machinery. Like it always blows my mind how Satoshi was able to come up with it and figure all the attack vectors and everything out like in his head, like while he was coding it, and while like he had to be so convinced that that's the right approach and that it has to work. Like it took him like I think 1.5 years to code it up, something like that, or that's he claimed to have worked so long on the design at least, and all the different transaction types and everything. And he also knew that it was set in stone from day one, as he also wrote. So he had to take care of everything beforehand, you know, like, and of course there were small bugs and stuff like that. But it, speaking of like what you can do with this system, the transaction types the transaction types you have to come up with in advance for Bitcoin to be like a universal settlement layer. That's something. It's insane how much foresight Satoshi had. Like he built everything into it already. Like he built in the scripting language that lets you do escrow contracts and multi-signature stuff and everything like that. Of course, you know, to enable multi-signature, we still had to do some fiddling, but all of that is only possible because of Satoshi's insane foresight. And he was just ahead of his time, like, yeah, no doubt about that. And he was definitely a polymath, because I don't think it would have been possible otherwise. And you see it in his writings as well. You know, like he knew what he was doing in terms of computer science and cryptography. Arguably, he wasn't the best coder. A lot of people pointed that out. Like, I'm not so sure about that. If you just want to get the first working prototype, so to speak, not prototype is the wrong word, like the minimum viable product, we would say today, probably. If you want to get that out of the door and you're like a one-man team, I think it can be excused that it's not up to Google's coding standards as of today or something like that. But he also knew that this doesn't really matter, because what's important is, as I said in the beginning, the soul of Bitcoin, so to speak, like what we call the consensus rules. And everything around it can change. And in the very beginning as well, people talked about like a second implementation. And Satoshi was like, yeah, that's probably not the best idea, because we don't want to have consensus failures and we don't want to have chain splits because of it. But still, it was obvious from the very start that what Bitcoin actually is, it's not married to the original code. So you can't really say, for example, today a lot of people argue about the influence of Bitcoin Core and so on. We have competing implementations and they work and they are in consensus. So you can definitely rewrite the code of Bitcoin. The soul of Bitcoin still stays intact, and the competing implementations are living proof of that as well.
I think that's a really fascinating concept to bring into bear, is the immutability aspect of this, where you have something that on the one hand it cannot change at the core level, and it's verifiable that you can rely on being the same, but it's also adaptable. It can evolve into what it needs to become. Is that a good way to
I think so. You hit the nail on the head that like it seems like a contradiction, but right, it actually isn't. And Bitcoin is full of those little paradoxes. And I still have to, like, I know I have a draft of a list of paradoxes somewhere. And I stumble upon this phenomena all the time. And I want to write about it one day. I'll eventually get around to it, you know, like after hyper-Bitcoinization, the latest, you know, on some boat somewhere. But another one of those paradoxes is that we have Bitcoin is something that generates absolute scarcity, and it does so by copying, and it copies itself all the time. Like everything in Bitcoin is copyable. Everything in Bitcoin is just information. Everything in Bitcoin is just text. Like you can't copy every piece of it. You can't even copy, like you can copy the block. Like the blockchain is copied all the time. Like the time chain is on every single node. You know, the code itself copies itself everywhere. Like it's absolutely everywhere, on distributed version control systems. The binary versions are on every node, and so on and so forth. You can also copy your private key. You know, like, it's not about having an uncopyable information. It's about like performing this intricate dance that makes invalid copies unusable. Like it makes certain kinds of copies invalid, and thus they have no value. But you can have 100 copies of your private key, and you can, like, again, like Bitcoin copies every part of itself. It even wants to, you know, like it wants to spread. The more nodes, the better. It wants to be very efficient in its block propagation, for example. So blocks are copied around all the time. It wants to be very efficient in its transaction propagation. So transactions are copied around all the time. It wants to have the ledger as secure as possible. So it copies it on every node everywhere. Like every full node has a full copy of everything. And the only reason why you don't want to copy your private key and give it to someone else is because those are like the magic words that can move your Bitcoin. But it's not that your private key is unique information that can't be copied. You can definitely, and I think you also, you should copy it, like not with a copier, but you have a steel plate and you have a paper backup and you have whatever you have, if you have a single signature wallet, and you have it on like 3-4 different places just to have a redundancy in case of a meteor strike or might be a bad example, but let's take a flood or your house burns down or something. And so I think it's really fascinating that this like, copying machine, and computers are nothing else than copying machines. Like you, that's the whole problem of the double spend problem. That's another thing that most people don't realize, and drives me up the wall sometimes. But computers can only copy information; they can never move it. That's why we have the double spend problem in the first place. Like the physical world works very differently. If I have an apple and I give you the apple, you have the apple. Like there is no magic copying going on. If you have a digital file, if you have a digital apple and you want to pass it to someone else, like you have one computer that has a photo of an apple and you want to move it to another computer or even to your USB stick, another hard drive, doesn't matter, like to another destination, the only way that works is that you copy the file, you check that it's still the same thing, and you delete the original. That's what moving does. Like if you see a moving file dialog, that's a lie. It's always copying. It's copying and deleting. There's no other way that it works. And even like that's how information works. You know, like if I have an idea and I share it with you, like the idea that I have is not magically gone. You know, like that's, we both have an idea. So and that's the realm that Bitcoin operates in. So moving something is completely impossible. And the way that Bitcoin achieves it is by this relentless copying. It's just copying and verification. At the verification bit is the important part. You know, like everyone verifies. We have these rules in place. There must not be any copies. And that's how Bitcoin solves the double spending problem in a way. Like everyone verifies the rules at all times. And the rules say copies are not allowed. But still, you know, you cannot forbid anyone to copy an information in the same way that you cannot forbid anyone to like to you cannot forbid an idea to spread. Like that's the same nonsensical idea. And so a lot of people get it wrong and they talk about tokens, for example, and as if there were like the only the only place where you can have an actual token, as we intuitively understand as a physical token, like an actual coin, like a gold coin, is in the physical world. There is in the digital world, there are only ledgers. that's basically the two main ways we have of keeping track of information. Like there are ledgers and token. And if you go back in history, like for thousands of years, if you have to count your sheep, for example, you either have a clay tablet and every sheep that passes by, you make a mark. And so that's basically a ledger. Or you, I don't know, put a bracelet around the sheep and you pull it off when it runs by again. Or I don't know what they might use. But that's the difference between, like, if you want to keep track of something, you only have tokens and ledgers. And in the physical realm, that is, you have those two things. In the digital realm, in the informational realm, you only have ledgers. Like that's how computers work. Like if you look at a hard drive, it's a ledger, for example. Like every single data, it's just entries in a database, so to speak, and all of it is a ledger. So yeah, that's a pet peeve of mine as well. So I wish more people would understand it, because I think it would lead them to a deeper appreciation of Bitcoin and deeper understanding of how Bitcoin operates as well.
So no GG tokens coming out soon.
Yeah, of course. You gotta milk that shitcoin money. Like that's
I see you, man.
That time will come again. Like don't you worry. The whole craze we had in 2017, I think the cycle will repeat itself again. And I'm just afraid that this time it will be real scammers. Like I wouldn't be surprised if we see a push in the direction of government shitcoins, and also what we saw, the initiatives of Facebook with Libra and stuff like that. And the downside of a government shitcoin, for example, is that you will actually be forced to use it. So I mean, we have that already with fiat money, but I think you know what I'm trying to say. We will actually have central bank digital currencies. Like that's the fancy word they use now. And we will have tokens mandated by governments, because it's just way easier. They also kind of have to get rid of cash, because we don't want to have something that can't be debased by a keystroke, and cash can only be, I mean, it is debased by a keystroke via inflation, but it's very hard to apply negative interest rates to the dollars under your mattress, because you actually would have to go knocking from door to door, as they did with Executive Order 6102. Like, the gold has the same feature. You cannot simply take it away magically via the internet. So you stuff it under your mattress or keep it in a safe. And if the government wants to confiscate it, then yeah, they actually can. And as we have seen historically, they will. And that's, of course, another thing that Bitcoin solves, since it lives in the informational realm. It's like, try to steal an idea, you know, like try to confiscate an idea. That's what we are talking about when someone wants to forcibly take away your Bitcoin. Because nobody, like, again, it's such a cliche saying in Bitcoin, like you only have to remember 12 words or 24 words, but that's something that you could actually do. And Bitcoin lives in the realm of ideas, that it cannot be stressed enough. And that's the most profound thing, in my opinion. Like, if society becomes so draconian and totalitarian that they go after your Bitcoin and you know what you're doing, then they will actually have to not only come knocking at your door, but really, like the mafia, you know, try to get you to talk. That's what we're talking about, because you can, there's so many ways in that you can store your Bitcoin securely in the informational realm. You can also encrypt your seed phrase and just put it on some cloud storage and remember your password. I don't recommend these kind of things. Like, always try to follow security best practices, because if you rely on your memory and you have a stroke, then your life savings are gone. So it's best to follow best practices, use hardware wallets, use multisig, and so on and so forth. But still, like, if push comes to shove, and if we see history repeat itself and people have to flee their country with hopefully their savings intact, that's something that they can rely upon. And the power dynamic that shifts the power dynamic massively. Like, it's very, very hard to overstate it. And we saw that articulated beautifully in the sovereign individual. And of course, every Bitcoiner worth his salt should know the sovereign individual thesis. And what this book basically lays out is that with the introduction of strong encryption, the nation state is doomed. Like, that's the one sentence summary of the book. And I think it's insanely interesting that we see the beginnings of that play out now. And Bitcoin, of course, has a role in that to play as well. But thanks to strong encryption, so basically thanks to mathematics, there is always a way to keep information secure, and there is always a way to communicate privately. And since Bitcoin is only information, there is now always a way to keep your wealth secure and to transact privately as well. And yes, Bitcoin has its privacy problems and so on and so forth. I don't necessarily want to go down this rabbit hole, but it just inverts the power balance completely, because nobody can stop you from, again, having an idea in your head. That's just, even with the most advanced dystopian technology, I think it will still be a long time until we have, like, brainwashing machines that can actually remove an idea from your hippocampus or from your frontal lobes. Yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of people still underestimate the profound implications that will have. And I think we see all of that play out already. That's another thing that fascinates me in Bitcoin, that, again, like, the book that I'm working on, it can basically be summarized in one sentence as, Bitcoin is different things to different people. And there are so many different things happening in Bitcoin right now. Like, with the recent news, we see now corporations coming in, and they're making, like, corporations moving to an actual Bitcoin standard, using it as their reserve asset. And that's very, very different from what's happening with podcasting 2.0, for example, what Adam Curry is working on. We actually have streaming payments now, And if John, if you manage to get this podcast into podcasting 2.0, people can listen to this episode. They can, in their user settings, decide how many satoshis a minute is worth. And every minute they listen, they're going to pay 10 satoshis, 100 satoshis, doesn't matter. And what's so beautiful about this streaming money concept is, you know, you can even set it up that like 10% of it gets automatically donated to BTC Pay server, 3% gets automatically streamed towards podcasting 2.0. You can split it up into your production crew, to yourself, to the panelists, what have you. And this is already there. And how many people know about that worldwide? A couple hundred max, you know? Like, it's so insane because everything is moving so quickly and everything is happening at the same time. Most people talk about Michael Saylor and like investment funds and insurance companies with, I don't know, like hundreds of billions of dollars moving into Bitcoin and deciding like single digit percent allocation because now it's safe enough and it has the blessing of the Giga Chat and now everyone can come streaming in. And that's what's happening as well, you know? And at the same time, we have like already we're almost there of activating Taproot, for example. And that's, again, a completely different thing, you know? Like, that's, it has nothing to do with the Lightning Network. It has nothing to do with podcasting 2.0. It has nothing to do with what's happening in the financial space and with people adopting, like companies adopting a Bitcoin standard. And all of it is happening at the same time. And all of it has synergies, you know, like the one drives up the price, the other one drives up the real world usage and helps people promote free speech and build up on free platforms. And the other one improves privacy on the base layer, which has implications all around, enables new use cases and so on and so forth. And those are only like three things that I got now from the top of my head. There's probably like 200 other things happening and 500 more that I don't even know about. And all of it is happening, you know, at the same time. So it blows my mind. And just today, for example, I talked in the past a lot about Bitcoin's voice over IP moment and how we are still like, those are the two things that I'm looking out for compared to internet history. Like, it's the voice over IP. Yeah, the voice over IP moment for the internet was everyone was like, nothing changed in terms of the telephones, really. Everyone was just still using telephones in the same way, but all the telecommunication companies switched to voice over IP. Very similar to how TVs switched from analog to digital, you know, like as the end user, you don't necessarily notice a lot of difference. Like, that's the infrastructure inversion is like the technical term for it. And suddenly everything uses a different system underneath. Nothing really changes necessarily for the end user. So for me, it won't be outrageous that in 10 years, everyone is still using like those stupid plastic cards or their phones to pay or their Apple Watch to pay. But it actually gets settled on the Bitcoin base layer. And all the banks and Visa and MasterCard and those who survive the revolution, like those companies that are still in business, they will be forced to use Bitcoin. They will be forced to use Lightning or similar higher layer protocols because they just won't be able to compete. Just like every telephone and communications company that did not switch to the internet. They are gone, like they're dead, you know? Like every single newspaper that didn't switch to becoming basically a blog, they are dead, you know? And this infrastructure inversion in Bitcoin didn't happen yet. But just today, I think it was just today, Jack Mallers from Lightning Strike announced that they're gonna go global very soon. And they're testing now the first transactions, sending dollars to Europe. And so you're sending $1 in California, wherever, and you're sending it to Europe. And on the receiving end, you receive exactly the same purchasing power, which I think is 0.82 euro or something. And it just comes out at the other end. And you only use Bitcoin as like this value communication layer. And you don't need any bank or anything for it. It just uses the Lightning Network in between. And on the one end, it communicates with the US bank account of the user. And on the other end, it communicates with the Lightning wallet and in the end the bank account of the other one. And this is like, I always call it the voice of IP moment because I still remember when the internet switched to like the telephony switched to voice over IP. Like, for me it was mind-blowing that you can have like have a call over the internet. Like, it was outrageous, you know. Like, I can still remember when you loaded an image online, it came in pixel by pixel, line by line, and you had to wait for like 10 minutes for any image to load. And even before that, you know, like text was loading character by character, line by line. And to actually be able to talk to someone over the internet, that was outrageous. And very quickly after that, every single, like, everyone who was talking online was talking over the internet. And nobody noticed, you know, like everyone was still just, yeah, maybe you got a new phone and you just, everything was still working the same. You dialed the same number and everything. It made different sounds or whatever. Like, maybe it didn't make a sound anymore. I don't even remember. But Bitcoin has the power to do this infrastructure inversion on the whole financial sector. And as the end user, you don't necessarily notice a change. Like today, most people are probably paying with, I don't know what, like Stripe and Apple Pay and Venmo and WeChat and I don't know, like you have some app and or you're paying with like an NFC bank card or something like that, or you swipe your credit card. Like, it doesn't matter. People really don't care how they pay, you know? And in the end, it will happen over Bitcoin because it has to. Otherwise, you're just not competitive, because the settlement networks that are currently used in the fiat financial system, they are horrible. Like, they're so expensive and so inefficient. It takes like it takes like a million blocks to settle anything finally, you know? And with Lightning, you have instant settlement. And it's just mind-blowing to think about it, what's possible. And the second thing I think I mentioned in the very beginning is the Eternal September, which we had in India as well. We are still in this like comfy, everyone knows everyone phase of Bitcoin. And it feels like there's like 200 people in Bitcoin. And it was the same with the internet, you know, like the good old bulletin board days. And every, like, yeah, every year a new stream of people came in, and it was always around September time. And there was one year where so many people kept streaming in, and the stream of new people didn't stop. And that was the Eternal September. And that's the internet that we have now. Like, everyone is online, basically. I mean, there's still like a billion people offline. So I don't want to say that we're done with the internet and internet adoption. But still, in Bitcoin, it's very, very obvious that the infrastructure inversion hasn't happened yet, and also mass adoption hasn't happened yet. I would even argue we are still before the early adoption phase. If you look at the giant S curve that Bitcoin will be in the end, like every technology that is fundamental will get adopted completely. Like, for example, electricity, running water, roads, stuff like that. Those are fundamental technologies. Also, the internet, of course, and mobile phones. Like, those are fundamental technologies. They stick around, they're very, very useful. So it's not outrageous to think of like full adoption. Like, everyone has a mobile phone, and you can see that even in third world countries, you know, like, it's the phones that get thrown away in the first world, they'll end up in the hands of the poorer citizens of the world. And with Bitcoin, it will just be the same, because you have entrepreneurs like Elon Musk. I mean, he's working on Starlink, bringing internet to the masses. Just, you don't even need any worldly infrastructure anymore. And I think it's obvious that all of this is happening. And we are still, if you zoom out far enough, all you're going to see in terms of adoption is a giant S curve. And of course, it's made up of smaller S curves. And that's why we have those adoption phases. And especially in Bitcoin, we have these hyperbolic rises and then crashes again. And I think this will still continue for a little bit, but there will be one point in time where, again, you have this Eternal September where it just, in terms of price, it just won't go down again. In terms of people streaming in, it just won't stop anymore. You know, like and also I think, even though having the Bitcoin ethos still around will be insanely valuable, like it is valuable in, for example, Linux kernel development. Those are very principled people, you know, like, also in general, the free software movement, you still have hardliners there that make sure that the ethos of free software and the philosophy behind it stays the same. But we don't talk about internet people anymore, for example, you know, like I still remember a time where you had to classify yourself as an internet person. so to speak. Like you were the weird guy that was online, you know, like nobody was online, and you were in front of the computer all day and online and just, you know, talking to strangers on the internet, and it was super weird. And like, what's this online thing? And what are even computers? Why do you need to have a computer? Like you're just a kid. Why can't you play outside like a normal person, like a normal kid, you know? And and today everyone is online. So the whole idea of like an online person, so to speak, doesn't really exist anymore. And I think the same will be true for Bitcoiners. So I really cherish the time before the eternal September in Bitcoin, where it's still this crazy world. And arguably, you know, like it's not as crazy anymore as it was. Like most people that are hardcore Bitcoins today are kind of normal people as compared to 10 years ago. You know, those were truly the crazy folks. But still, I cherish the time that we have right now, that it's still kind of a small community. And I think it's also very important to get this right, you know, like to hash out all the arguments, to agree on certain principles, for example, to clarify the ideas. And like we need this time as well to make sure that we, as a Bitcoin community, so to speak, and I know a lot of people hate this word, but still, I think it's undeniable that there is a group of people that wants to see Bitcoin succeed. And I think we have the highest chance of success if the chance of success is higher if we still have a little bit of time, and if not if everything is happening at the same time, if you get what I'm trying to say. So if everything would happen at once, I don't think it would be good. But still, I'm hyper bullish as always, and I think it will happen faster than most people and most Bitcoiners expect.
That's a fascinating concept to think about, especially in relation to the nature of the time chain that you were talking about earlier, where the order of events is sort of probabilistic, but it orders things in a very reliable way. It's almost like built into the system, where the adoption curve is also taking place in that progressive reliable way. But go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, please go ahead if you have a question.
I'd like to, I think, you know, if I'd love to open up to anyone here, anyone with any other questions at this point in time. As we wait for anyone else to chime in, one of the things that stood out to me while you were talking was the broadcasting, the ability to broadcast and transact in value in real time on a global scale is absolutely fascinating. Like I was just letting that sink in, like imagining that we are here in this group, small group, interacting online. We're all over the world. You're coming from Austria, right, Gigi?
Yeah,
and I'm an
Austrian through and through.
And so imagine that, like, we could just be it, but it, but with the light, with the Phoenix project in podcasting 2.0, what it's enabling is for us to be able to stream value to each other in real time on that global scale, as if we were standing next to each other, just, you know, giving each other small bits of value just by our own attention. So it's like, it's able to, you know, for, and within the digital world, I think the social media companies and everything are realizing, and it's pretty well known, that people's attention is what the value is on the internet, right? These social media companies are trying to aggregate people's attention and spent over periods of time in order to sell advertising and monetize them. So it's kind of like farming their energy, you know, as you know, we Oh man, yeah, we're going into like the energy farm realm here, but what this enables is for us to be a lot more deciding or discriminating with our attention giving and actually put it where value is more due, more efficiently.
Yeah, I think so as well. And I think what's interesting about that is that most of the things that will enable, we can't even imagine yet. It's very similar to the internet, you know, like the basic structure of the internet didn't really change much, you know, like we're still sending packages back and forth, but now we have like video conferences on like a daily basis. I mean, thanks to the lockdowns and everything as well. But yeah, they're like the stuff that we are doing now daily was dreamed up in like the 60s and 70s with like e-commerce and like everyone will have like a personalized TV that is inside your watch and whatever. Like they got the details wrong, but they got the basic ideas right. But there are so many things that they like you just cannot foresee what kind of how technology is going to be used. And I think streaming payments are a very obvious example. Like we can't even make up the use cases that people will come up with, you know, like that there's only maybe the killer app for again I hate this phrase, but still, maybe the killer
I use it the other week too. Use it talking about podcasting. Guys, it's a killer app.
Yeah, it probably isn't, but it is a very, very nice niche use case. And in a world like in the current political climate where deplatforming and having access to any user-based funding is almost impossible, especially if your ideas are like outside of the mainstream. Like that's a perfect niche application for so many people. Like you can actually monetize your content in an honest and fair way, and you don't have to rely on advertising. And I really like the saying also of Adam Curry, who says that advertising is censorship, because for one thing, you're not allowed to talk bad about your advertiser. Like that's a given. Like you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. And also, like if you're getting big enough, you don't want to piss off your sponsors, so you self-police and you self-censor, and you're maybe tuning down your opinions. You're maybe, you know, like trying not to swear as much anymore. Whatever, what have you? We see it all the time. You know, like compare Joe Rogan now with Joe Rogan when he was really small. Like it's a different world. You know, like and he's definitely self-censoring, and he's like, I think he's still one of the most outspoken and honest people in comparison to many, many others. You know, like he basically doesn't give a fuck most of the time. But still, you know, like the how you make your money and who is actually putting your food on the table matters a lot. And I think having the possibility of use of funded business models, so to speak, it changes everything. And I think it's obvious that all of this is going to happen. It just takes a little bit time to develop. Now with Patreon, for example, and also like Kickstarter campaigns and GoFundMe and whatnot, people are kind of, they realize that this is the way to go anyway. And now we have GitHub sponsors and so on and so forth. And we have like Twitch streamers that get subscriptions. And a lot of people are making a living in that way. But I think it will be even better and even like even more freedom enabling if it goes directly from peer to peer, if you don't need a third party platform that authorizes those kind of payments, and if you don't have anything that can deplatform you. And I, of course, I'm not saying that all of it will be utopian, because it won't. Like the whole idea of a utopia is completely misplaced, because there will also be people that do all kinds of super crazy fucked up shit and abhorrent stuff, and they will be able to make money as well. But that's good. Like Bitcoin is it's money for enemies. Like if that wouldn't be possible, then like the whole idea of Bitcoin would have failed. And I think the same is true. Like a lot of people say also Bitcoin is free speech money, and it's the same idea. You know, like you don't want to police speech, period. There will always be people that say nasty stuff. That's just the way it is. But you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Like, we know from history, from experience, from the deepest ideas that we have, like that's the deepest enlightenment idea, so to speak, is it's paramount for a free society to have free speech. Once you start policing speech, everything goes down the drain. And with free speech comes also the permission to say nasty stuff and to say something that's abhorrent for most ears, so to speak. And in a sense, money is just another form of voicing your opinion, voicing your preference. And in a sense, money is just another form of speech. And so policing money also leads to disaster, in my opinion. It's even more profound than that, because money is a communication tool. It's like a distributed communication system of value. Like, markets are the language of value. And once you start interfering and policing these markets, you're basically policing and censoring speech. And this always has bad effects. It always has bad side effects. And we see that all the time. Like, we see that with political interference in markets that just distort. It distorts everything. And the worst distortion that we have currently, of course, is fiat money itself, with the endless money printing that's going on, especially since COVID hit. I mean, again, I'm sure almost everyone who listens to this will know this number, but like more than 20% of all the US dollars in existence were printed this year. You know, like it's insane to think about that. And that completely distorts every single price signal. It completely distorts every single economic calculation everyone in the whole system makes. And it's especially a crash, but it's happening all the time. You know, like 2% stable inflation, 4% stable inflation. And again, like, that's something that drives me up the wall, because there is no such thing as a stable inflation, stable increase. Like a stable percentage increase is always exponential, you know, like it's anything but stable. So as the Austrians like to say, you know, there is no thing like mild inflation. Mild inflation always leads to outright inflation and always leads to hyperinflation. And that's just, if you plot it on a graph that's like plainly obvious, it's just, if you increase something by a certain percentage of itself, it's an exponential function. And at one point you'll hit the knee at the exponential function goes parabolic. So even if you have like 0.1% inflation, it's catastrophic over long periods of time. And so Bitcoin is perfect in that regard, because Bitcoin, as Rob Breedlove has pointed out as well, and others point out as well, it has the perfect monetary policy. Like, it's zeroed in on zero, on the number zero. It has 0% inflation. Like it's so beautiful that we have this perfect monetary policy. And the outcome of it will be approximately 21 million Bitcoins. I mean, there's a debate around how many will still be in circulation. And it's also slightly less, a couple of Satoshis less than 21 million Bitcoin. But still, it's the 21 is the number, 21 million. That's like, as we like to say, 21 million is not negotiable. That's what it's about. And I think it's so fascinating. Like, just with in this conversation, we touched on so many different things, that the absolute scarcity aspect is absolutely paramount. But it only works if it's also censorship resistant. Like, if you would be able to censor it, you could also mess with the money supply. That's how the system is intertwined, you know. And it also, the base layer of Bitcoin, it enables these kind of crazy ideas like streaming payments and all other kinds of crazy constructs that did never exist before. Like, for example, even like a multi-signature wallet. It's such a crazy idea, you know. Like, you actually, it is a little bit like, you know, like a magic like a magic realm, like sorcerers from the past, you know, like three sorcerers need to meet up in front of the door and everyone has to speak his part of like the I'm not good with impersonating any wizards, but like Gandalf in front of the Mines of Moria, and he forgets what he needs to say to open it. Like, that's basically Bitcoin for you, but you just need to gather a bunch of people and they all have to say the same thing. Like, that's a multi-signature wallet, you know. And it's just magical. It's crazy that we have this kind of thing. And it will still continue, you know, like something like podcasting 2.0, just 5 years ago, it wouldn't even, like, it was out of the question to build something like that. The Lightning Network didn't exist, and to build something on top of the Lightning Network, like, it's not a chat application that integrated the Lightning Network. It's a Lightning Network application that just was like, fuck it, let's build a chat on top of it. And now we have a chat. Let's just integrate podcasting. Like, that's super easy. And it took them only a couple of weeks, I think. Like, Adam Curry was talking about it. Like, he was blown away that in a couple of weeks it was live, and it just works. And it works because we have the foundation now. We have the base layer. And even I would even go as far, like, everything is still evolving. So I would say Bitcoin is still kind of in beta, so to speak. And the Lightning Network is still reckless, but still, even at this point, I would say the base layer is super solid. Even the Lightning Network is super solid, and you can build working applications on top of it. And it can also scale, you know, like, it's very hard to estimate how many people use it and how many transactions are bouncing around in the Lightning Network, because there is just no way to tell, really. But it obviously works. Like, I'm using it every day. Like, and as a lot of other Bitcoiners like to say, you know, like, if people tell you that you cannot use Bitcoin for any kind of transactions, you're just plainly wrong. Like, if there are so many people that just do like 20 Lightning transactions every single day because it's just so much fun, and just it's just a couple of satoshis back and forth, and I don't even care if I'm gonna regret it, you know. Like, I really like Laszlo's approach, you know. Like, who gives a fuck that he spent 10,000 Bitcoin for two pizzas? Like, nobody should give a fuck, because he's the guy who invented GPU mining, and, like, you know, like, 10,000 Bitcoin at the time, that was like 200 satoshis for us now, probably. And so I don't believe in the, you know, you never must spend, so to speak. If I can spend a couple of hundred satoshis for a good cause or for another Bitcoiner, in my opinion, selling is a sin, you know. According to my religion, selling for fiat is a sin. But if I'm getting like a cool fingerboard or something and it costs me a couple of hundred satoshis, I'm willing to part with those satoshis, like, no problem about it. And also, I think what a lot of people don't really understand is, Once you go all in, once you move to a personal Bitcoin standard, there is no way out of spending anyway. Like, you have to spend to eat. And Pierre Rochard, he pointed it out in 2014 already. Like, people will be forced to adopt Bitcoin. People will be forced to spend their Bitcoin. And I think we saw all of it happening already. Like, there are so many individuals that move to a Bitcoin standard, and they're earning Bitcoin as well. Maybe they don't have to if they're lucky. And they're forced to spend as well. Like, they still have to probably pay rent or buy a house or whatever. They have to eat at least. And so they are forced to spend. And I think the more people, like, once your balance sheet is 100% Bitcoin, you're obviously forced to spend. And once a lot of your peers have a balance sheet of 100% Bitcoin as well, that's where circular economies can start to emerge. And we're still a very long way off of that. But we already see it happening. Like, the Citadel 21, I like to point out that example all the time, because Hodlonaut and Katia, they paid everyone who worked on it in satoshis, and they only take satoshis for the magazine. So that's a mini circular economy right there. And there are many other shops as well that just won't take fiat anymore. Like, your money is not good here. We only accept satoshis, you know. And I think we see that popping up more and more in the Bitcoin space, of course, at first. But it might also make sense to, like, I'm guessing it will also pop up in other areas where it's just very difficult to get money in any other way. You know, like, we saw it in the Silk Road. Like, your other money is not good here. We only take satoshis. At that point in time, of course, it was called Bitcoin because the valuation was different. But still, I think we will see a rise in all of that at the fringes, so to speak, at the edges. That's where the innovation happens, and that's where the early adopters are. And in the end, I think it will only make sense that also companies and larger institutions, they will probably start to pay their their employees in sats, and they will probably also at least, you know, switch to it in the sense that this is now also an option. And I think, you know, it was very misguided in the beginning to view Bitcoin as a payment technology and not as a savings technology. It's definitely a savings technology first and foremost, and it will remain that for a very long time, for the foreseeable future, because fiat money is just broken. And I think that like the real time to spend is when there is no fiat left, so to speak. And this will it's just a process that has already started. And how long it will take for all fiat currencies to collapse, you know, like nobody can say that. Governments are really good at keeping up charades and playing games, but it can also happen quite quickly. You know, like I'm also not convinced that it has to be a collapse and rebirth. I think it can be a transition as well, very similar to how we saw with the internet and print media, for example, like the death of the newspaper and the rise of just online media, or the death of, let's say, cinema and movie rentals, stuff like that, and the rise of Netflix. Like it wasn't necessarily a catastrophic collapse and rebirth. It was like a gradual thing, and it was clear. Since years, it's clear that this is going to happen. And if you're smart, like if you're a smart newspaper, you move to the online space. If you're a smart DVD rental or something, you also try to do something similar like Netflix. And if you're a smart bank, then you're probably switching to Bitcoin as your settlement layer, or you're integrating Lightning into your credit card payments or what have you. Of course, a lot of things will change because the Bitcoin world is very different than the fiat world. Like I don't see, for example, a lot of credit, a lot of loans with insane interest rates, stuff like that happening. Like it's just the fact that you cannot print more Bitcoin will change things drastically. Just like the internet changed things drastically in the terms of print and publishing, you know, like it's, I mean, you could argue, was it for better or for worse? That's a different rabbit hole to go down to, but the way that the news works and media works in general has changed drastically just because the nature of the internet is different. And I think in the financial world and in the savings world and in just the financial constructs that are going to be built on Bitcoin, and also the kind of payment infrastructure that is going to be built, it will be similar, but it will also be very, very different, because just the underlying reality of Bitcoin is a different one.
Awesome. Yeah, the whole circular economy thing is really interesting to me. Bring it back to what you were talking about, how the internet was in its early days, just a small group of people kind of chatting and online all day, interacting in this way. Right now, it does kind of sense that, like, if I want to trade on only in Satoshis, it's somewhat limiting in terms of like who I'm going to interact with, who's going to do business with me. But you see that growing rapidly, and even what I find fascinating in that, as I've kind of thought about that and kind of gone down those that whole circular economy rabbit hole in my mind, I've thought about how, like, if I have a core group of friends within the Bitcoin community who I know are looking at that as their primary store of value, it's not, if I want to interact with them and transact with them, it's almost like I don't even need to require payment from them. It's almost like having a friend of mine that needs a place to crash, or he's visiting town. Like, I'm going to accommodate him in my house, and, you know, give him food, give him shelter, and give him whatever he needs, because I care about him as an individual. And I know that he would do the same for me. Should he be in that same scenario. So I almost see this new, it's almost like a new culture of like chivalry or of generosity really developing here, where you know, like, I was just in California visiting family, and I got to meet up with a lot of the OC Bitcoin network guys. Jason is here watching, and he's one of them, and it was so cool to meet these people who I automatically have so much in common with, and I can understand a lot of the way that the ways that they look at the world. And we can hang out in Brian's house as complete strangers, yet he welcomes us there, and he can say to us, like, after that one meeting, this guest house is for you guys. If you ever, you know, are in town, like, come, like, hang with me. We'll hang out. And he's offering that, and it's just this very organic exchange of value, rather and no sats were even exchanged hands, yet we have that, like, that exchange of value there. It's like another layer, right?
Yeah, it reminds me of an idea that exists already. I don't know if you know the app, but it's called Splitwise. And I really like the idea, because that's basically also how the Lightning Network works, but that's beside the point. But the way that the app works is that basically, if you, for example, you have the same group of friends all the time, and one day you pay for lunch or pay for drinks or something, and you just enter it in the app, like I paid that and we split it equally among us four or something. And you basically, you can decide when you're settling. So the app takes track of everything and who owes what to whom. And it doesn't necessarily mean that any transaction has to happen, you know, like you can look into the app and you say that, okay, I'm owing everyone like $10. So this two rounds of beers, I'm going to pay, and then we're all even again. And so on. And so it reminded me of what you just said. And I always like to bring up this app because a lot of people know it. I don't know if it's region-based. I think in Europe, a lot of people know it. And it's basically how the Lightning Network works. Like, that's the best easy explanation of how it works, so to speak. And you only settle when you really have to. And yeah, of course, that's basically what you did, but without writing it down, of course, and also without any promise of any actual final settlement ever. So that's what we call a favor.
Right. I think that, and I'll just keep shooting questions here. Anyone feel free to jump in and raise your hand or unmute yourself to contribute. But that reminds me, you know, of what is developing as or what people talk about as a social contract, you know, how in governments or different jurisdictions, people say that we're cooperating on this layer or this level of agreement, where everyone kind of has a general assumption of what to expect when they go outside. They're not going to get shot or robbed because there's a social contract in place. And one of the main criticisms, I think, of anarchist ideas, or libertarian ideas, if you want to have a softer term, is that without governments, who's going to make the rules? Who's going to establish that social contract? Right. And like, who's going to build the roads? Like, who's going to be responsible for all these types of things? I think that's a very interesting realm to go down in relation to how Bitcoin can establish this very basic level of a social contract
that
can be built on.
Like, it's I like to think about, I had this insight which felt like an epiphany a while ago. That was basically shortly after Riga, and I had this idea in mind of how Bitcoin, like, truly works, so to speak. I'm not sure if I got it right, but it's just like this idea kept popping up again and again and again, and it drove me mad. And I'm still kind of bad at articulating it. I tried once with a tweet that I called circularity, and that's basically how the social contract in Bitcoin is enforced, so to speak, and basically how Bitcoin operates. But basically, as we said in the very beginning, or as I started this whole journey, that first and foremost, Bitcoin is an idea. So the idea of Bitcoin was there even before the implementation. And we still see this, that the idea that Satoshi had, he came up with this social contract. He came up with these consensus rules. And so you can see Bitcoin definitely as this idea. So I know I'm repeating myself over and over again, but I think I really want to drive home that point, that Bitcoin is living in the informational realm. Bitcoin is an idea, and the whole soul, the essence of Bitcoin, like the social contract layer, if you want to call it that, the consensus rules, they are an idea. But of course, we also have the Bitcoin software, which is implementing this idea, which is realizing this idea. And with this implementation, the implementation gives rise to a protocol, which is implicitly abstracting this idea, which is implicitly abstracting these rules. So you still, you take the humans out of the equation. Someone had this idea, like Satoshi had this idea in the beginning, but by implementing it in software and letting computers take care of the rest, you automate and abstract this idea so that you don't have to have humans in the equation anymore. And of course, that's not entirely true, you know, like that's why we have all had all these debates, and upgrading Bitcoin is always still a debate, and in the end, you know, like humans are operating nodes, and humans are writing the code, and that's why we had the hard fork and everything else. But still, like we go from idea to software to protocol to computer network, because once the computers start to communicate using this protocol, you create a network, and you span this network. And with this network, there emerges like the fact that this network can reach consensus. This is what gives this whole thing value. And the way the system works, the value is denominated in a native, absolutely scarce asset. And to this asset, you have complete property rights. And this is like, it goes from idea to technology to finance and so on and so forth. And the idea that, like the image that I had in mind was like, we have these five steps, and I will actually have to look it up, because I have no way of doing that live on air. But it basically starts with the idea. It goes to the implementation, which is the technology. It goes to finance, and we saw all these steps, and we also saw it with the adoption of Bitcoin. You know, like before Bitcoin existed, it was only the idea. Like it was the five people that I mentioned in the very beginning, like Hal Finney and Wide Eye and Nick Szabo. They were working on the idea. You know, like those were the idea people. And then we had the tech people, like the cypherpunks. Hey, this actually works. We can hack this together. And wow, this implementation, it actually works. And well, let's work on the code, and let's improve the code, and so on and so forth. And then we had the first degenerate gamblers and traders jump in. You know, like yeah, it's now a financial thing, and we can 100x leverage into BitMEX or something. I mean, that was a little bit later, but I think you get my point. We have these kind of stations, and the stations that I wrote down in this tweet thread of mine is like, we went from idea to technology to a financial system to a social thing, where this is a social movement. We started with the Silk Road and other things, like the libertarians discovered it for themselves, and it's like free speech money and so on and so forth. And with the social movement, there comes a cult, and that's where we people come in. You know, like I'm definitely part of a cult. Like I would even go further, and that's where we close the loop and we go back to the idea. I would even say, like, once a cult gets big enough, it becomes a religion, and religions are basically formed around ideas. You know, like every religion has like a meta idea, or like I like to call them memes, because basically, you know, like it's basically memes all the way down.
Or mythology.
It's a fancy
archetypal.
Exactly. Mythology. Archetypal mythology is a very fancy word for a meme, for a very strong meme. It just won't go away. And so Yeah, I expanded on that thought and on that image. So the five main points are idea, technology, financial thing, social thing, cult, and then back to idea via the path of religion. And there's in between as well. Like you go from idea to tech via code, you go from tech to a financial thing via the fintech revolution. You know, you go from a financial thingy to a social revolution via investing. So this, the savings technology, suddenly Bitcoin becomes a social movement, and you want to actually, you know, like the fact that you can actually keep a purchasing power and can go into a binding contract with your future self, so to speak, it gives rise to a social phenomenon. You know, like you have the hodlers, you have the as Dan Held said, hodlers are the revolutionaries, and we see like this is on the rise right now as well. You know, like it is definitely a social revolution and a social phenomena, and all of that, everything that's done in the educational realm and events like this, it all helps to educate more people, and it helps to bring more people into this cult. And so then we're at the cult stage. And again, like my insight 1.5 years ago or so was that we're at the cusp of the religion step, so to speak. And I say that half jokingly, you know, like it's Bitcoin has a way of taking possession of you. I always like to say you cannot really possess Bitcoin, but Bitcoin can definitely possess you. And so what I said at the time, and I still think that I this is kind of right, is don't be surprised if a religion continues to form around this thing. So that's in my opinion, religions are the most powerful ideas, and Bitcoin is equally powerful. It's such a powerful idea that I wouldn't be surprised if we continue to see religious metaphors used, and we have like religious fervor surrounding it, and we'll have priests and high priests and everything like that, and all of them will be nailed to the cross at one point and just lit a fire, and everyone has to suffer at one point in time or get slain entirely by the hive mind. I think that's just the way it is, and that's just the way that Bitcoiners operate. And
I see the headlines coming in Newsweek or something. Prominent Bitcoin advocate says that Bitcoin is a religion and a cult.
Yeah, I mean,
advocating membership.
That's, I think that was even already part of a couple of headlines, but yeah, sure. I think just this list of things that Bitcoin is, and this also the fact that it is this big loop, like it kind of it always loops back to the idea. And we see that all the time with upgrades to Bitcoin, for example, like what kind of works and what doesn't. And the stuff that works, like it's definitely influenced by ideas. Like the code is influenced by ideas. The people that write the code, for example, and the people that run the nodes are influenced by ideas. That's why also the user activated soft fork succeeded, for example. A lot of people thought that's the right idea, and they thought miners should be the slaves of the network and not the masters. And that's definitely an idea, and it influenced the behavior of the people that are running the nodes, and so on and so forth. And so this like self-referential feedback loop, that's basically how Bitcoin works. And I think it's so insanely fascinating that it managed to bootstrap itself out of nothing. And all of it is self-referential, you know, like you have no external influence, monetarily speaking, on the network. Like it's set in stone from day one, and it just, the fact that it absorbs value from the outside, that's what gives it relative value. And I think the correct, like I had this insight not too long ago, like Bitcoin started with zero price, and it will end up with zero price again, because we won't have any fiat money left to measure it. Like Bitcoin will be the measuring stick. And so and since every fiat money is basically worth infinity as compared to Bitcoin, you have 21 million divided by infinity. You know, like it doesn't compute, but it's basically zero again. And shout out to Knut, who beautifully said that, like imagine everything there is divided by 21 million. And he had this graphic of like 21 million divided by infinity. And that's basically what's going to happen. Like that's the end. That's the very end stage. Like that's post hyper Bitcoinization. That's where we'll be at. And so it bootstrapped itself out of nothing, and it will, again, compared to fiat currencies, it will be incomparable. Like the number, again, like zero didn't make any sense, so to speak. And again, the number in the future won't make any sense. And I see we are currently at the Bitcoinization step. So the phases of Bitcoin, as I see them, we already went through the two most important ones, and everything else will just take a little bit of time to play out. So Bitcoin definitely was a 0-to-1 invention. So the most important, I would say like the second most important step was actually building the system and actually making it work. So actually implementing the code, launching it, mining the Genesis block, all of it. But keep in mind that Bitcoin, first couple of months, I don't remember exactly how many months it was, but it was probably like half a year or something. It had no value at all. Like it wasn't traded for anything. It was just sent back and forth between a couple of people, like cypherpunk enthusiasts. It had no, like the price of one whole Bitcoin was zero, like 0 cents. Like it had no exchange price whatsoever. And I think the most important step was for people to act as if this thing was valuable and say like, I'm gonna send you, and a lot of people point out the pizza transaction, which was the first transaction that for a real good. But Bitcoin had a market price before that. Like there were some people that were like, you know, if you can wire me some money or whatever, or pay me with I think it was even PayPal or something, I will send you that many Bitcoin. So there was an exchange price before that, and it was like super super low, of course. But this first step from 0 to 1 in terms of evaluation was the most important one, because ever since that step, the self-referential feedback loop kicked in, and it was like, as a miner, you can actually make money, you know, like people are actually willing to pay something for that, and everything just goes from there. And ever since that point, it's like game over for for every fiat money and everything else, because this self-referential feedback loop is unstoppable. It will only stop if there is no other measurement left. And I truly believe that. Like we are still in the Bitcoinization phase in the very early stages. There will be a hyper-Bitcoinization phase just for the reasons outlined before, just like there is no stable inflation. There will always be like a knee in the curve. And I think Bitcoinization will, over time, at one point in time, we will look back and we will say that this was the year where just everything happened. And it's very hard to pinpoint that exactly, just like when was the year of the internet, for example. I mean, the internet absolutely took over and won, but I can't really tell you what was the year. I can't tell you approximately. And the same is true for like the smartphone revolution, for example. When was the year when smartphones took over? Was it the iPhone launch? No, I think it was a little bit later, and so on, you know? And the same will be true for Bitcoin looking back. It will be obvious that Bitcoin is all there is, just like the internet in terms of sending information back and forth. The internet is all there is. Like everything else can be discarded, like letters and shit like that. It doesn't matter anymore. And the same will be true for Bitcoin. Like nothing else will matter anymore. And looking back, it might be hard to say one, like when was the point, but it will be obvious that it happened kind of all at once and then it won. And so hyper Bitcoinization is very hard to define. And in the end, that's what I call stage O. So you have like stage N where Bitcoin has value, and stage O is when Bitcoin is omnipresent. Post hyper Bitcoinization, like you Bitcoin is absolutely every, it's like running water and electricity and the internet. Like if you walk into any room nearby, you'll automatically connect to Wi-Fi. So internet is omnipresent as far as your mobile phone is concerned. Like it's absolutely everywhere all the time. And the same will be true for Bitcoin. You just, no matter what you do, no matter what kind of financial transaction you take, and just keep in mind, you know, like every second, like every half of every transaction that is not done out of love, that's where Bitcoin will show up. And this is the omnipresent stage of Bitcoin.
That is so mind blowing. So what you're saying is, in essence, Gigi, is that Bitcoin is the second coming of Christ? Is that
yeah, exactly.
That's what you're saying. That's what you're trying,
what I'm trying to say. Of course.
we do have a couple questions here that I missed. We've got about 15 minutes. Thanks so much for all of you guys for hanging in here. This has been just an amazing day. But one was from Ian earlier on Well, so this, I'll do his later question. This one kind of relates to what we were just talking about. What happens to the transaction costs when no Bitcoin can be mined?
Yeah, keep in mind that we are still super early. So we are still in the bootstrapping phase of Bitcoin in terms of that there is actually an additional block reward. Like that's only the first phase of Bitcoin, and it will end in the year 2140 approximately. And what's going to happen is that the block subsidy, like currently we have to pay transaction fees on the base layer as well. Like the incentive is split between the block, like the reward that miners get for finding a new block, and the transaction fees that are that people are willing to put in. And that's just a free market. The transaction fee market is just a fight for block space, so to speak. And at one point, this will take over. And we see that with every single bull run. Like, I mean, I'm a strong believer in one sat per V-byte transactions always. So I have a low time preference. I don't mind if a transaction of mine takes a week to confirm or something. But the mempool still clears. And so far, the main reward of mining is the additional reward you get for finding a new block. In the future, this will be very different. But we can already see when stuff gets crowded and the bull starts to run, that people are willing to pay insane amounts of transaction fees. And the way that Bitcoin works is the transaction fees is not coupled to the transaction amount. So you can send it for pennies, even if it's like $1 billion, you know, like it doesn't matter. So in turn, that means that small transactions are not very efficient on the base chain. So when fees are high, even if you want to just send $20 worth of Satoshis, then you might have to pay a high transaction fee. And that's what kicked off the whole block size debate and everything else. But the short answer to your question is fees will take over. Miner will be compensated for the service they do. It will be a global settlement layer, not a payment layer. And miners will just settle very large transactions and they will be rewarded for it handsomely.
That really helps. He also wrote, what do you think will be the crossing the chasm moment for businesses to adopt Bitcoin for everyday transactions? It would be in a business's best interest to start utilizing it sooner, correct?
Well, that depends. Not necessarily, because currently it depends on your jurisdiction. In the US, for example, every transaction is a taxable event. So if you're paying your employees in Bitcoin, like that's it can be a nightmare. If you're somewhere else where that isn't the case, it might be even like more frictionless than any other payment system. Like for me, for example, I sometimes pay other Bitcoiners just for fun because someone, I don't know, creates a logo for me or proofreads something, and I'm like, just send me a Lightning invoice. I'm gonna send you 10,000 sats, whatever. Like I want to pay people actually if they do something nice for me. Like I think it's you know, it's an important thing to kind of you know, like I really like Bitcoin. I'm having a very hard time to part with my Satoshis, but if someone does something for me, I want to show my appreciation as well in giving them a couple of Satoshis. So I think it depends on the jurisdiction the business is in. It also depends on just why you have exposure to Bitcoin. I think most businesses will be like MicroStrategy that just see that the fiat world is crazy and the ice cube of fiat money that they have on their balance sheets is melting. So they will use it as a store of value first and foremost. But maybe if you are, for example, doing a lot of cross-border payments or are even like a remittance business or something like that, Bitcoin is perfectly well suited to adopt it as a medium of exchange for your business. And just keep in mind, you know, like it depends on your viewpoint of Bitcoin. If you take the viewpoint that Beautyon has, for example. It's just like a value transfer protocol. It doesn't matter what you stick in on the one side and what comes out on the other side. So if you use it for remittance payments, it might only be Bitcoin for like 10 minutes or something, you know, like or for however long it takes. And you just use it to send value and to circumvent either capital controls or the insane fees of the fiat financial system. So it just depends on the circumstances. But I would expect that this is still a couple of years off. So it won't happen this cycle. I would be surprised if it happens next, but it might happen next cycle. But after that, I think we have a high chance of just because of the fact that fiat, more and more fiat currencies will collapse. And we are running headfirst into a global financial and monetary crisis. It might just happen quicker than some people think, because having Bitcoin will be the smart thing to do. And if you are a flexible company and your employees demand Bitcoin as well for various reasons, then it might happen quicker.
Awesome. Thanks for that. Herman also had a question. And maybe Herman, you can jump on here and elaborate, but I'll read it for you. Is Bitcoin not using universal time? From the Earth looking at the stars, starting in the 70s, what happens when the second overflow happens, January 2038?
So he's talking about Unix time. I think he's alluding to the Unix timestamps that started in the 1st of January 1970.
That's what I can you hear?
So, yeah, I can hear you somewhat.
Hi, Christian Stilwell, Servus teacher.
Servus. Sí, sí.
Servus. Yeah, read for that side, you know. The point is, I read that the time is running out because it's in the 70s where the time is running in the seconds to the timestamp. And in January 2038, it's running out. So is there something new implemented there? Or what's going on there?
Yeah, like I think changing the timestamp field wouldn't be too much of a problem. It's a good question. I actually haven't looked into the Unix timestamp problem, but that's definitely something that can be patched, because again, what's important for Bitcoin is the order of blocks. The block time is important, not necessarily the timestamps. And there are some sanity checks that if a block has like a really outdated timestamp, like 2 weeks old or something, that it gets rejected. But in the end, it doesn't matter. The only very like thin connection to human time is with the difficulty adjustment. So the actual human time measurement that matters in Bitcoin is only because of the difficulty adjustment for creating the time chain. The real time doesn't matter too much. It only matters what came before and after, so to speak, and you can determine that just by a causation of the hashes, so to speak.
Okay.
Because you need to have the thing that produced the hash has to exist before the hash. That's how time works.
With difficult adjustment, Gigi, sorry to interrupt you. I mean, the question I sent you on Twitter was, you take the time that the 2016 blocks take in seconds and you divide it by the actual time in seconds, gives you the quotient, right? And you have got a quotient of 4.
Exactly.
And that's what you hash. That gives you the difficulty adjustment. And that's what you have to find with the nonce. Is that right?
Yeah, that's. I think that's right. And again, like that's why human time is still like important in Bitcoin, but it's not as important than most people think. If we wouldn't have that link to human time, then Bitcoin would just run away. But it would still, you know, we would just produce blocks way too fast. So it's a way to not cheat ourselves.
Yeah, but it's really, you know, I just wanted to get my head around it. So thank you for answering that. You should get your Sphinx shit sorted out. I can't log into your 21. Try.
Right. Oh, Yeah, we have a great German community, and we have our own little Sphinx chat.
but you can't get in there.
I think you can, but I think you need an invite or something. Just spam the Telegram group, and Marcus or someone will help you.
I'll do that. Thank you for your help. Cheers. Nice one.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Ciao.
Ciao.
Awesome. Thanks, Herman. Gigi, that was absolutely just amazing. Thank you so much for taking so much time, especially after a 3-hour cosmic discussion with Alex on another podcast. You seem to be tapping into the infinite energy there, into the cosmic realms. Satoshi is blessing you today on this blessed Saturday.
You know, like if you talk Bitcoin, it's just time flies. It's literally all the time. I can't even believe that it's like 1 a.m. my time already. It's just time flies. It feels just like, I don't know, I just started talking.
Awesome, man. Well, do you have any other closing thoughts before we close things off?
Yeah, in general, I always like to say, just don't be intimidated by Bitcoin. I know it's very much to take in. And if you're new, then probably like 95% of what we said or what I said doesn't make any sense. And just take it slowly, try to understand it step by step. Also in terms of, you know, like setting up wallets, securing your private keys and setting up nodes and stuff like that. Just take it step by step. Everyone did, like every single Bitcoiner, you have to take it slowly and step by step. It's very easy still to mess things up and lose money and shoot yourself in the foot. Just don't do that. Follow best practices, read, try to understand it. Just don't try to be smarter than everyone else and to just do it in your own way. It's not a good idea. But also along the same lines, just also try to have fun with it, you know, like it's a little bit of tinkering still, and it's a little bit of experimentation, and it's novel and new and weird. All of that will go away, just like it did with the internet. All of that will be abstracted away. But now is the time to tinker and try things out and have fun with the technology and spin up a Lightning node and the China Sphinx tribe and stream some Satoshis and whatnot. Like it's the perfect time. And if you want to do even more technical things, like you can set yourself up with like multi-signature stuff and do, I don't know, join Rodolfo and get like a ham radio and send some transactions over the air. I don't know, there's so many things you can do. Just explore the space, have fun, and try not to be too reckless.
All right, you guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode with Gigi. I had just a tremendous time talking with him and interacting with some of the other guests in the session. We got very deep into some of these amazing concepts around how Bitcoin truly is something brand new that the world is having to grapple with. And Gigi, I think, does an amazing job elaborating on what that actually means. He spent so much time looking deeply into what Bitcoin is and is able to really translate that to us other plebs, you know, in a way that we can understand and kind of interact with. It was a very enlightening experience. And once again, thank you to Gigi, and thank you guys for listening in. Really appreciate your time. And with that, until next time, may you live a meaningful life and enjoy your freedom as a sovereign individual.